It's my view that genetic resources will be key to developing high-yielding bioenergy grasses, and that's my conclusion, and I'm going to spend the rest of this talk explaining why I think that's so. Northern adapted warm season C4 perennial grasses are among the most promising candidates for developing sustainable dedicated bioenergy crops, and these include miscanthus, switchgrass, prairie cordgrass, and big bluestem. These four species, or groups of species, have a number of shared features, including the fact that they're outcrossing and the populations are highly variable genetically, phenotypically. They have wide geographic distributions. They're rhizomatous to various degrees. They have a polyploid series. And perhaps most importantly, they're in the very early stages of crop development. So unlike all the other crops we heard about this morning, these are really things that need to be domesticated. This represents an important opportunity as well as a huge challenge, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later. So I thought it's good to take a little bit step back and talk about what yield is for bioenergy crops. I would define yield as a net energy gain per area per year. Now, this is obviously related to dry tons per acre per year, but it's not quite equivalent. So if you have a situation in which you put on a lot of nitrogen fertilizer from fossil fuel derived sources and do a lot of green cuts, you can increase dry tons per year, but you won't have a net energy gain. You might actually end up with a loss. So the systems that are going to be needed are going to need to take advantage, in my view, of perennial growth and recycling of nutrients that normally happens in these perennials to underground structures. And I'll talk a bit more about that in later slides. So yield components that are really important for this are height, including stem elongation genes, and flowering time, which is going to be very critical, and especially the short day trait. Tiller density, of course, number of tillers per area, and this is directly affected by rhizome length. So there will be obvious ways to use the germplasm to improve these traits, as well as tiller diameter and filled versus hollow stems. So variation for height and tiller density, some examples. This is Miscanthus giganteus, and it's a very tall plant, as you can see. This has been grown in Europe for biomass for about 20 or more years with various degrees of success. There is one clone in Europe that predominates, and that's the same clone we have in the US, one genotype. And that's what the whole industry is based on right now. And that's very narrow. It's an interesting cross. The X here, of course, denotes that it's an interspecific species. It's derived from Miscanthus sacrophloris, which is quite rhizomatous, and Miscanthus sinensis, which is more of a tufted habit. This particular clone that we grow is an allotriploid, derived from Japan in the 1930s, imported to Denmark. So that's what we got. Now, it seems very unlikely that this one clone is going to be randomly the best one that we could ever have. There's probably a lot of diversity, certainly within sacrophloris and sinensis, that we could tap to make better versions of this. For example, the variety sacrophloris called Lutera riparius is grown in southern central China in Hunan province for paper production. It's very high yielding. This is a diploid, this is a diploid, this is a triploid, of course. You can see within sinensis there's quite a lot of diversity for height. Here's a plant in the wild that's over 4 meters. This is a variety that's an ornamental in the U.S. called Little Kitten. There's some agapanthus in the background. It's not even a meter tall. So a lot of diversity to work with. Here's some switchgrass varieties showing different height characteristics and variation in tiller density. Just as an introduction, here's prairie cordgrass and big bluestem, some of which can get quite tall and are very promising as well. These photos are, of course, from D.K. Lee, who's my collaborator at Illinois. These are some more height variations in just the establishment year. These are quite young plants still. And then in year two of prairie cordgrass, also some differences in height among ecotypes. There's an octoploid type from the west, which is not as good as the eastern tetraploid type, at least in Illinois. I'll show a little more about that later. So I'd like to point out that natural distributions, of course, relate to adaptation, And adaptation is inextricably linked to yield potential because it's always genotype in the context of environment. And there's two major driving factors here. There's the north to south variation, which affects flowering time, especially the short day trait, as well as hardiness. And then the east to west variation, which is going to affect drought tolerance and salinity tolerance in the materials that we have available to work with. If you look at the Miscanthus germplasm, which is native of Asia, you can see that Saccharophloris is a more northern species and therefore has a lot of northern adaptation for cold tolerance. It's as far north as over 50 degrees latitude and from southern Siberia. Sinensis has a broad distribution from quite far north to the tropical regions. Floridulus is more tropical in origin. It's evergreen. I should point out one thing here, and that's in Japan, there is a species that they call ogi, and it's an allotetraploid. It is rhizomatous and looks a lot like Saccharophloris, so in the literature it's often called Saccharophloris, but there are no true diploid Saccharophloris in Japan, and so really our triploid giganteus that we're using is a backcross to Sinensis from those tetraploids. So I think we've got tetraploid giganteus and triploid giganteus, and there needs to be some working out in the literature. But the other key feature of this slide that I want to point out is that Miscanthus is closely related to Saccharum. In fact, you can get fertile interspecific hybrids, and also closely related to sorghum and maize. And so we can learn a lot about Miscanthus just by these other close relatives. Distributions for switchgrass and prairie cordgrass and big bluestem is quite variable. A large east to west distribution for all of these, and for most a very large north to south distribution. So this is a precipitation map of the U.S. showing it's very dry in the west, of course, very wet in the east, and that'll affect adaptation to those traits. There's a similar map for China, which I'm not going to show you. There's a lot of variation in north to south hardiness zones. Here we have tropical and subtropical kind of climates, and here we have very cold temperate, similar situation in the United States. This also represents a huge variation in latitude and therefore day length adaptation. And in the far south of China, you will actually find Miscanthus types that are short day, whereas of Sinensis. And in the north, of course, they'll be day neutral or not strongly short day. So this is the kind of variation we can use to breed higher yielding varieties. Now, genetic resources for optimizing flowering time for yield. Flowering time is a major, is an adaptation that's a major driver for yield. And this is familiar from our experience with maize and sorghum and sugarcane. The photos that Jeff showed earlier this morning are a great example of that. If you want to have a high grain yielding type, you want to get rid of the short day genes and you want to breed in dwarfing genes. If you want a high biomass type of sorghum, like for sugar or for forage, you want to have the short day genes and you want to have the genes for tall stems. So it's the same sort of thing. And in fact, they're mostly the same genes, and since we have a lot of syntony within the grass family. Sugarcane, we've bred this to be quite short day so that it doesn't flower and ruin our sugar production and our biomass potential. So same themes for Miscanthus and these other crops. Now, if we put some of these other crops like Miscanthus and Spartina in common garden experiments, we can see that northern plants, if they're brought to the south, are going to flower early and go dormant early and yield less. Whereas if we take plants from the south and bring them north, they're going to flower late, but the dormancy may be delayed and hardiness might be reduced. So in my view, north-south crosses are going to be very important to optimizing yield and to get the late flowering for increased yield, but also to bring in the adequate dormancy and hardiness. I think major advances are going to be obtained by decoupling flowering time with the onset of dormancy. So we can have very late types that don't flower in production regions, but will go dormant in spite of not flowering. And some hints that this is possible comes when we look at some plants of Miscanthus or for example, prairie cordgrass. You can see here in this field of prairie cordgrass at the end of the season, it's going dormant, nice yellowing foliage, putting it into the underground structures. Some of them have flowered and some of them have not. And you see the same sort of thing with Miscanthus. Some will, in that, especially the first establishment year, not flower and yet go adequately dormant, yet others won't flower and they'll stay green. And others, of course, will flower and go dormant. So we have variation that we can work with to get an optimal type. This is an example of Miscanthus sinensis variety condensatus, which is adapted to maritime Japan. So you can see here we have, you know, zone, what is that, 8 throughout most of America, or 9 throughout, it's a very mild climate, even though this is, you know, up here it's 49 degrees latitude. And what happens in the Midwest is that this plant at 28 degrees Fahrenheit in the fall looks like this. It's green. It just doesn't want to go dormant. And then it'll get killed off by frost, which is not ideal for nutrient use recycling. However, these plants are very tall. They're late flowering. They're robust. So if we can get in through some crosses, material that will be short, will go dormant at the right time, in spite of not flowering, we'd have a good type. Now, there's been some very interesting work that's been done in Japan a long time ago. In the 1950s, a cross was made between what they were calling Saccharophloris, but that's really the allotetraploid type, back to Miscanthus sinensis. So recreating what we would have had is Giganteus, and what they got is two hybrids back, two progeny, one of which was triploid, which is what they expected, and one of which was tetraploid, which was unexpected, probably due to an unreduced gamete. And this kind of result has been repeated a number of times already. The interesting thing in this case is that in the 80s, another group of researchers looked at these very materials in the field very closely, and they found that the yield of the triploid in this case was not as good as the yield of either as the Miscanthus parent, but the tetraploid was very high yielding, almost double. And the reason for that was the structure of those plants. So the very clumping habit of the sinensis, condensatus type, whereas the Saccharophloris and the 3X parent had very long rhizomes, so a low tiller density. This is dry weight on a per meter squared basis. Whereas the tetraploid had a more optimal intermediate phenotype of tiller density and rhizome length. And so I think this is a good lesson for the kinds of things that we need to select for to optimize yield and the kinds of crosses that we need to make. This is an example of Saccharophloris variety Lotaria riparius that I mentioned. It's quite rhizomatous. It's not been used much in this country. It's barely been brought in, I believe. And this photo is taken from a bridge, and you can see this entire field, which is growing along a river in Hunan province, is a monoculture of this plant. And this is the harvest of this plant being stored for paper production, an example of dry storage of a biomass crop on a large scale in China. Now, rhizome and tiller density variation also occurs in prairie cordgrass. We have a northwestern type that's tufted and a southeastern type that's spreading. Again, I think there's an opportunity, there's intermediate types in both of these. I think there's an opportunity to improve yield by developing an ideal combination. Rhizomatous growth can lead to dense, pure stands, and that's advantageous. It fills in gaps, but we have to worry about the hollow center phenomenon of grasses, which can be a bit of a problem. Rhizome length and tiller density obviously can be optimized. Now, polyploidy, switching gears a little bit. Miscanthus has a 2x to 6x range of both auto and allo polyploids, and it appears so far that 3x and 4x interspecifics are the most promising types, whereas in switchgrass we have 4x, both lowland and upland cytotypes, as well as 6x and 8x upland types. In prairie cordgrass, we have a tetraploid as well as hexaploid and octoploid. It looks like the tetraploid is more promising than the octoploid in Illinois, but the hexaploid is sometimes best, but not always so. So there's a bit of variation to play with here. And in bluestem, we seem to have hexa and 9X. Here's an example of some new varieties that were developed by Tinplant in Germany. This is an interspecific between the tetraploid Ogi, or what they sometimes call Saccharophloris, and back to sinensis. This is a triploid. This is essentially a new version of triploid Giganteus. So it's an interspecific at the triploid level, very high yielding, very high vigor, excellent plant. That's Martin Deuter, the breeder. And then this is a diploid by diploid sinensis by Saccharophloris cross that he also made. And these are showing a lot of heterosis. You see a lot of heterosis in these interspecific crosses. These are not as good, the diploids in general, as the triploid in terms of yield, but they're much more cold tolerant. In prairie cordgrass, here's an example of the tetraploid being a lot better than the hexaploid. And here's another example of the hexaploid being better than the tetraploid. The hexaploid being better than the tetraploid, so it can go either way. The geographic distribution Here we have the western type, which is octa, and the eastern type, which is tetra, and some natural hexes being found here. That work was done by D.K. Lee. And heterosis, you know, these are outcrossers, so we certainly expect to find a lot of heterosis. We need to characterize population structures. That really hasn't happened yet for these crops. Potential heterotic groups need to be tested. For Miscanthus, like I said, it appears that Saccharophloris bisonensis can lead to heterosis. And for switchgrass, it appears that lowland by upland at the 4X level can lead to heterosis. This is a phylogeny that came out of the UK showing some variation in a germplasm collection that they have there. Here's the Japanese sinensis. Here's the Chinese sinensis looking a bit different with Korean in between. Here's some more China sinensis, looks quite different from the others. So one could start to play around with potential heterotic groups based on information like this. So to wrap up, what's the current status and need of germplasm here? If we look at what accessions are available in the national germplasm system here in the US, it's really quite meager generally. I think there's about 18 that's currently available for Miscanthus. Switchgrass is in the best shape with about 175, and there's recently, of course, been some good additions from Florida. Prairie cordgrass, I find one. And then Big Blue Stem 19. Now, of course, there's a few groups in the states who are working on the native species that are starting to amass more collections, but this situation really needs to be improved for the long-term viability of these crops. These are early days in breeding for bioenergy. Therefore, germplasm is going to play a major role in improving yield. We should find a lot of variation that gives us higher yield or yield-related traits relative to what we have in our hands now. But at the same time, we need to really amass those collections and start the evaluations and take advantage of the information that's available from grass relatives like maize and sorghum. So additional collecting is going to be needed to establish a strong foundation for breeding success. And in my view, the NPGS is the best place to curate collections to ensure that the industry is well supported and that progress is not impeded by a lack of access to germplasm. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions. China is, the question is, have I had any success with germplasm exchange with China? And the answer is not quite yet. I'm certainly talking with various groups that have been collecting Miscanthus in China. The researchers themselves generally want to collaborate. They see advantage to it. I'm really exploring options right now for allowing that. It seems at the national level, there's basically an indecision as to what to do with Miscanthus in China. And it's been suggested to me that perhaps the best approach to this is to enlist the aid of the Foreign Ag Service here at USDA, who have regular contacts with their Chinese counterparts and bring up the issue for dialogue. You know, I was recently at a meeting in Wuhan, and a professor there, Gang, who actually who's a dean now at a university in China, but had a long career at UC Davis. You know, he made the point that if we don't all work together on developing alternative renewable sources of energy, we're going to, as countries, China and U.S., end up competing for fossil fuels, and that's not a position that would be desirable for either. So it's much better to cooperate, and I hope that message will have. So some weight there as well.
Anything else for Eric?
Eric, would you care making like providing an idea of how much time you're going to have to need, or the crop in itself, or the new discipline will need in order for us to start becoming more dependent on biofuels?
Well, so the question is, how much time will we need to develop the crop to these crops to have more dependence on biofuels? I think the industry will start now with what we've got. And really what we're waiting for And of course, it'll improve a lot once we can improve the germplasm. But I don't think that's the limiting factor. I think the limiting factor is primarily policy decisions. Right now, we have RFS, right? So that's renewable fuel standards. But that requires a very large investment to build new capital, very high capital investment plants. And in this economic climate, I think a lot of companies are having trouble making that work. I mean, I just saw a talk a few months ago by a USDA representative saying, you know, they've got these programs to lend companies money to do these sorts of things, and it's hard to get people to take them up on it, you know, big companies. There is some projects going forward. You know, there's the big BP plant in southern Florida that's going to use energy cane. But what we're really missing is cap and trade or some sort of system that will encourage the coal-fired power plants to use some bioenergy. And the federal government seems to have not taken an act, you know, the Congress hasn't acted on that. And so it may be that the states are just going to start to lead the way in creating some mandates. That would be the lowest bar. That'd be the easiest thing to do. Those capital investments are already there for the coal-fired power plants. And in order to substitute some biomass into that to reduce carbon emissions wouldn't take a lot of investment.
Anything else?
So then the time to collect and preserve all that it is there, it's for that type of crops, really, which is a new endeavor and everything, it is now, right?
Absolutely. Now, yeah, strike while the iron is hot, because number one, we're in a rush to meet the need, and number two, there's a lot of interest, so there should be funding there for it.
Is there any funding? I mean, are there any organized ways to go after that objective?
Oh, there are, and there's two different kinds of ways. One is with somewhat private kind of money, you know, from a company or whatever. That leads to the problem of that ends up having IP restrictions. And, you know, so that'll be good as long as the project is good, but long-term preservation of materials tends to require a more public effort, in my view. USDA, of course, has a program of sponsoring germplasm collection trips. I've actually already put in an application to go and collect in Japan next year. We would expect to hear in December whether that's approved, and then, of course, there would need to be negotiations with their counterparts in Japan about how that would all work out. So we would be hopeful that other kinds of trips, both in the U.S. as well as in other countries, would be funded. And that, but I think the biggest factor is, now, I think USDA would probably be quite receptive to this. What worries me most is the negotiations with other countries, because I think everyone's worried about holding on to their germplasm and not being at a loss. I think the way to approach it, though, is to come up with an arrangement in which the other country will benefit ultimately from commercialization in the U.S. Most of these countries in Asia, for example, they're not going to put in large areas of bioenergy grasses. They don't have the land to dedicate to non-food crops that we might have in this country. And so if you think about, there could be over 20 million acres in the U.S. to dedicated energy crops. If they get a small percentage of royalties back, that could be a huge advantage to them. And so it's a matter of structuring it, but it's hard to do that at the national level.
Any other?
Well, was just a conference where 200 countries signed an agreement to share profit, but the U.S. was a major country that was not present. Yeah, there was an international, they came to an agreement, and they are going to share profits. The U.S. was not there.
Well, I hope they're... So the comment was made that there was just an international conference between about 200 countries to agree to share profits on from germplasm, but the U.S. wasn't present. Which conference was this?
I think it was in Japan. I was in Brazil last week and I saw it in a newspaper, which I didn't even know that it had just happened. You know, European countries, China, Brazil, all the major, you know, big diversity.
Well, I hope the people who are from USDA here will take this message and relay it back to people who can make decisions, because I think we really do need to be a player and an active participant, if not a leader in this. I appreciate that comment.
Okay.
Thank you.
We do have all of the...